නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස බුද්ධං ධම්මං සංඝං නමස්සාමි. Is my voice okay at the back? Can you hear me? Okay. The monks have just expanded this room. It's double the size now. Double your. It was just in time. So, welcome to the folk from Elmont, from United Church. It's very nice of you to come and join us. Where to begin? Just in terms of Buddhism, there are many schools of Buddhism, and that can be quite confusing. You sort of have to understand the history of Buddhism, where it moved from India, which countries it moved to, and then how it evolved in those different countries. So within Japan or within China, there are even lots of schools of Buddhism. China less so because of communism now. But this particular school is known as Theravada Buddhism, and the place that I trained in was Thailand, and there's a lineage of monasteries and teachers in Theravada Buddhism, which is called the forest tradition. And it's a tradition where the monastic community live in rural areas rather than urban areas, and they try to develop a lifestyle which is simple, with some self-sufficiency in how they live, but also an interdependence with the laity. So as you saw with the meal, we have this connection where the laity take care of us in this way. So the monastic community has its own culture, and that runs in parallel to the lay culture, and the laity can always come here and participate in our life according to the facilities that we have. And then they go back to their own situations, their own family situations. So it's like two cultures that are running parallel and that try to encourage each other in this spiritual work that the Buddha suggested. And it is a different culture because we're not, first of all, we're not economically dependent in the usual way of stocks and bonds and recessions and all of that. So it has a different kind of temperament, obviously, and the simplicity and the renunciant quality of that. And in this tradition, its emphasis is on trying to use just the things of daily life to understand oneself, to cultivate awareness, and in that kind of self-understanding to liberate the heart from all the modes of greed, hatred, and delusion that cause suffering, the fears and angers and so on. So it's an ongoing practice of mindfulness. And mindfulness is a really lovely thing to be able to do, to kind of be able to sit down and just compose the scattered mind onto the breath. This is a marvelous thing that we can do as human beings, just to take whatever we're doing, whether we are weeding a garden or whatever thing we're doing, to take it as a way of collection, of composure. Because so much of life, modern life, is very, very scattered, very busy, lots of things to do, lots of deadlines to meet and such like. And so the hope in this kind of environment is that the doing of things is very important, not simply some deadline or some goal that one has to achieve in a restless kind of way. Meditation is obviously an important part of Buddhist training, and that's the way we do look at the teaching. It is a training, a cultivation, and the training has a goal. The goal is sometimes talked about in terms of liberation from suffering. Sometimes it's talked about in terms of realization of Nibbana, the deathless or the unconditioned and the uncreated. And that's done through looking at the inner conflicts that we experience as human beings, between each other, with our environments, with our bodies, and to see that these conflicts that arise as greed, hatred, and delusion are something that we are often creating. Yesterday I was at the Quaker. We have a session at Quaker House fortnightly in Ottawa. And I was kind of reminiscing about the good old days. This is what old monks do. They reminisce about the good old days when it was really tough. But I came to the monastery. I didn't know how to meditate. I just wanted to be a monk, a young fellow. And so I just got into the environment. Everyone just sat on concrete floors. And we had a little bit of cloth. There were no chairs. Very rare to see a chair in the whole monastery. And I really only discovered what meditation cushions were about 4 years later. So physically, it was quite demanding. Unfortunately, I was young and it was more flexible. But the teacher would always just say, you know, I'd be kind of moaning about my sore knee or moaning about the food. And he said, well, why do you suffer? I said, yeah, well, because my knee hurts. Yeah, yeah, but why do you suffer? And he always asked us to look at our own hearts and our own minds, to take responsibility. He said, you can move. You can move if you want. Well, I'm bored or mosquitoes are biting me or whatever. And the first talk I ever gave as a monk, and it was difficult because Ajahn Chah asked me to give a talk in Thai. And I didn't know Thai very well, and I've lost even that. So I tried to, you know, some kind of simple Thai language, and it was, my first talk was Ajahn Jung, and Jung means mosquito. Mm-hmm. Ajahn means teacher. And in Thailand, there was a fair number of mosquitoes, probably not as spectacular as here, but they were definitely an intrusive part of one's meditation. And there was a kind of theory among the monks that body heat attracted the mosquitoes, right? So if you kept cool, they'd bite the next guy. So all these weird theories. But it was very hard to be patient with that. It's just really very hard just to be patient. And yet it was such a good teacher. So sometimes you'd be sitting in a mosquito net, say, and there would be that one that got in, right? I think we've all had that, tense. That one mosquito that got in. And it wouldn't land and bite. You know, if it would just land and bite and take its blood and be quiet, I can meditate. But I can't meditate as long as this thing's buzzing around my ear. But Ajahn Chah would say, well, yeah, what is meditation? Is it just having life according to the conditions that you want? Is that what meditation is? All nice and nicely packaged and peaceful and no mosquitoes and no bugs and no pain and no... Or is it just learning how to be at peace of the way things are? And just that little lesson of the mosquito net, the temptation to kill it, of course, but then that was against the rules. Not that I felt that with great compassion for the mosquito, to be honest. But you live within the rules and within the training. And then there's the aversion. And we're going to see, well, that's the aversion, isn't it? It's the problem. It's not the sound. And it's not the sound. It's the aversion to the sound. The sound is as it is. It's what I'm creating around this. And that kind of simple lesson, again and again in the same mosquito net with probably the same mosquito or another mosquito, becomes quite profound. And why is it profound? Because it's a kind of model of the way I'd suffer around things I didn't like or didn't want. The aversion to the chanting, or aversion to pain in my knee, or aversion to the mosquito. So Ajahn Jung, the kind of the mosquito teaching me how to be at peace with the way things are, how to accept the way things are. Now these kinds of lessons in monasticism that we learn quite often come because they're repetition. You get the same problem arising again and again. And it's very simple. It's not overwhelming. It's not like being in Darfur or something awful like that. It's very simple, something very simple. And yet, the mind doesn't know how to be peaceful with it. The mind suffers from aversion. And this way of cultivating insight, understanding, a peaceful heart, one of the phrases I like is the craft of the heart. And the image of craft I find very appropriate to developing a spiritual life, because if you think about how you learn to drive a car, how you learn to bake bread, how you learn to knit a sweater, when you begin with any kind of complex project that you're doing, there's so much information. So if you're driving a car, if you think about all those things that you had to keep attention on, the road, the gears, the speed, all the rest of it, it seems like, how do I do this? And yet, by just trying it and doing it and getting in some instruction and trying it and doing it, trying it and doing it, trying it and doing it, insight arises. And that insight is not something which is that you kind of just think about. It's something that in the doing, there is the arising of insight. And that's part of any craft. The way you learn how to weave, or if you're a potter, or even gardening or anything like that, you do, don't you? And you notice, so slugs are like this, and this one doesn't like the cold, better plant it later, and this one likes more sun, and this one likes different kind of fruit. You learn by doing. You learn by doing. And so the doing of meditation, or the doing of what we sometimes call the Buddhist project, is like that. It's a craft where the goal of the craft is to create a beautiful product, and that's a beautiful human being, a being whose heart is open, whose heart is peaceful, and isn't just kind of reactive and a slave to circumstance. But that's not easy to do. It's very difficult to train the mind, and all of us find that. It's not, the mind can just kind of go all over the place very easily. It can be very, very reactive. But isn't that the way also you learn a craft? That you have difficulties in the recipe that you're reading, or something that you're planting, or there's too much water. You face a difficulty, and in the willingness to engage with a difficulty, to look at it, to see cause and effect, you eventually come up with a solution. Someone might advise you, but you're questioning, your inquiry, and you're watching cause and effect, eventually you come up with a solution. And that process of insight is part of the craft of the heart. Even though one might read the books and understand it intellectually, the delusion of the mind is really tricky, isn't it? And so I know for myself, I suffered a lot from fear and shyness. And even though my teachers could say, well, what the problem was, my own delusion around that was quite strong. And I just had to watch and witness and suffer through. But it's that taking of responsibility and then witnessing to my own suffering, not blaming it, not denying it, not distracting it, but just watching, what is the cause? Why does this conflict arise? Why do we get alienated from people? And then watching very silently, not just analyzing, but watching in situ as things happen. And that's craft, isn't it? How do you actually learn how to drive? Well, you do it, and all of a sudden you know how to do it. Not all of a sudden, gradually, you know how to do it. Now if you think, like, I drove here from Ottawa with Stan, and we had a really good Dharma discussion, and he managed to get us here. Through all the traffic and the rain and me blabbering on about Buddhism and so on, and that's a quite a complex situation going on, and that's all been learned. The mind is quite complex. The emotions are quite complex. But what's really, really simple is awareness. Awareness is the most simple thing, because awareness is simply the background of knowing of the changing conditions of emotion, bodily feeling, sensory input, and all the rest of it. And it's in that awareness that we try to find our refuge. So when we talk about, in this chanting, we talk about refuge in Buddha. The Buddha is our historical teacher, but also we use the word Buddha as that which is awake or awareness. So when you take refuge, when this is how we speak, we take refuge in awareness. So say, let's say like in this meditation, if you feel discomfort, when you feel discomfort, the discomfort is just a natural part of being human, whether it's emotional discomfort or physical discomfort. And that discomfort arises because of causes and conditions. You feel your hip is tight or whatever. Then you can certainly move, you can go and you can leave and all the rest of it. And you can also just learn to witness the discomfort. Now that awareness is not the discomfort. Discomfort is an object. And one of the lessons in meditation, in the craft of the heart, is to see that discomfort can be known and you can remain peaceful. You can remain still. You can remain aware. And one of the lessons that's learned by reacting to discomfort. So typically in meditation, when people start, they feel discomfort and they want to move, or they rigidly hold themselves or shouldn't move. And through that struggle with discomfort, they come to a good lesson. And the lesson is, oh, discomfort is this way, but that which is aware is actually quite peaceful and silent. And that intuition of, well, that's the refuge, it's awareness, not the discomfort. Don't attach to discomfort, know the discomfort, move if you have to. But discomfort is just an object. And begins to, first of all, relax the body and also give a very important lesson about all of life. That when we have all the discomforts that we have in our relationships or in our work or whatever, that awareness is the refuge. It's not something out there. And we can respond, but we don't have to react. We don't have to be slaves to it. So in the craft of meditation, the craft of the heart, the lessons that we learn and the mindfulness that we develop over, like, if this is just 40-minute meditation, that's not long in life. If you're not used to meditation, it might felt like 4 hours, but it's not really a long time. But what we're doing in this craft is that, like, for 40 minutes, we're trying to be aware. We're really present. And the mind wants to go here, there, and everywhere. Present. Now that builds up a power in the mind, the power of awareness. And that power then plays out in the rest of the day. It plays out in the way we are responding to people in our family. And if we're reacting from a place of discomfort, from a place of alienation, from a place of aversion, from a place of fear, because we've practiced deliberately awareness for 40 minutes, that awareness is going to show us something about that. We're going to be more on the ball with it, and we'll understand more, and there's more chance of insight. The opening of the heart is a very important part of any life, let alone a spiritual life. And we have the capacity to evoke things in consciousness. We also have the predicament of being afflicted by things, aren't we? So I have a memory of someone that has harmed me, and it comes up, and I feel aversion or I feel betrayed. That's a kind of affliction from things that have happened to me. Now, if I just follow these afflictions of circumstance, if I just let the narratives of my mind play with them all the time, so I remember some betrayal that happened to me, and I let my thinking mind be a victim of that memory of betrayal, and I keep reinforcing that in my mind, oh, they did this to me, that means a lack of freedom. I just become a victim, don't I? So on one hand, the craft of the heart is saying, learn to abandon that which is unskillful. And that which is unskillful is attached to through thought, through wrong thinking. So I've been betrayed by someone, and I really trusted them, and they just, they did something really inappropriate. Socially, I can say, that's wrong. You can't do that. That's immoral or whatever. But inwardly, it still hurts, and I still have memory. And that memory comes up, and then what I do to attach, I attach to it with a narrative. A narrative involves ego and self. They did this to me, and they did it to me. And to keep that narrative going, I have to reinforce that negative memory, don't I? I have to keep reinforcing that incident. They did that. And then my whole being is alienated from life, contracted into anger or whatever. It's an extreme. So we try to, obviously, we try to abandon that. And the way you abandon that is by fully feeling these negative afflictions as they come into consciousness, but not following the storyline. So there's not repression, but neither is there indulgence. And this is the life of non-attachment. Knowing that this is just a feeling. It's not a pleasant feeling, it's just a feeling. It's just the same as a painful hip. Be patient, it will change. And as that capacity for watching these afflictions gets stronger, we are no longer afflicted. Right? That takes a lot of work. That takes a lot of work. So that's that aspect. But the other aspect, which we did during this meditation, is the capacity to evoke. We have the capacity to remember that which is wholesome. You say something like generosity. We all feel generosity. Natural, isn't it? But what we're trying to do in the cultivation of the heart is actually take something like generosity and reinforce it in meditation. So one of the things that I have a practice I do where I go through a kind of history of my teachers. From the first book on awareness I read as a university student, and then there's someone, a Danish fellow that I met at university, and then there's this Spanish guy I met in Malaga, and then there was someone in Morocco. I said of a autobiography, but it's all my kind of people or books that have been influential, and I try to bring up gratitude. And that's really a wonderful kind of opening practice. Now, it's not that I don't feel gratitude, but if I don't put some kind of effort into that, gratitude can just be another circumstantial thing. You're kind to me, I say thank you, I feel grateful, boss, it's gone. But actually to take something very wholesome and then cultivate it, make it stronger in the heart, gives the heart this kind of strong sense of openness. And that's what the craft of the heart is about also, taking the wholesome and sustaining the wholesome, making it strong in the heart, making it vibrant. So this practice of like bringing a friend into consciousness and evoking that, we can do that. It's not like you're manufacturing, but you can, like when I think of my mother, because I'm very close to her, I really evoke that feeling here, right? And then just really hold that feeling in the heart, quite deliberately, and then on the out-breath, and just keep doing that. That's very skillful, very wholesome. So on one hand, you're letting go of the negative, and on the other hand, you're developing the positive. But the positive is a kind of strength of consciousness. You know, it's a clarity of consciousness. It's an openness of the heart. And as that is strengthened in us, then the afflictions of delusion, of greed, hatred, delusion, egotism, and all that, they have less power to delude. And because this does produce a very beautiful sense of inner well-being, a real strong inner fulfillment, practical, not just as an ideology, but quite realistically, existentially, you know, viscerally, it's very, very fulfilling. Then the need for external distractions, the need for compensations outside of us and all of that that our culture so encourages, the need for that falls away. Because one's found one's fulfillment in the heart. And because the fulfillment in the heart is here, it's mine, then there's a tremendous outpouring of generosity. Because what else is there to do? What else would you do? I've got this body, I've got this time, I might as well be generous. Because one's own needs are no longer based on some kind of externality. Now we can't always feel open. We can't always feel grateful. Because oftentimes we don't feel grateful. We just feel ticked off. You know, we're fed up. We hate ourselves. We think we're you know, basket cases. We're full of doubt and all of that. And the craft of the heart is accepting that, but not believing that that's who you are. So not grasping the narrative, not grasping that what we call self-view, and just seeing this as it's just a movement. And the way we do that is we try to use awareness around the present moment to keep composing the mind. So if you have your mind starts to throw up a lot of doubt, what am I going to do? Or speaking to someone, who has a lot of very realistic doubts about their pension now because of this awful, you know, stock thing, and this poor person has lost a lot of money and so on. And on a practical level, she's doing what she can do. But then on the level of the heart, her mind keeps going to worry and fear, which seems pretty natural. But in the cultivation of the heart, that's the practice. That's what you're working with. You don't want it, but that's what you're working with. And how do you work with that? Well, when the doubt and fear come up, one learns to just do things very mindfully. So mindfulness is a way of staying present in the moment, composing your attention in the moment, and letting this run its course, not denying its existence, but not getting sucked into the personal narrative. You notice, like, if you feel like, say for this person, how does worry work? Well, this person keeps thinking what's going to happen in 10 years' time. And it is worrying, because you don't know. And there's less money than there was October 2008. So there's cause for worry. And I could say, oh yeah, I'd be worried too. Right? Well, that's okay, I'm a monk, I don't have any money. And I'd be worried too. And then we could feed each other. And on a practical level, yes. But as a spiritual practice, what is it? What is worry? And worry is thought. First of all, it's an uprising of emotional content, fear, whatever. And then there's the storyline, isn't it? There's a narrative. And what do you do with that? Well, you try to stay with the upwelling, but you try to use the present moment to compose your attention and do what you're doing. And so we say, if you sit, sit. If you walk, walk. But don't wobble. I was just watching something about the Tassajara bread book. Remember that? From the Zen monastery in Suzuki Roshi's. The guy that wrote that, he asked Suzuki Roshi, so Roshi, you want me to be the cook in the monastery. How do I do it? He said, well, when you cut the tomatoes, cut the tomatoes. When you peel the potatoes, peel the potatoes. Now that not much sound like much, you know. But actually, to compose your mind around what you're doing in the midst of like strong doubt or strong anger or strong fear is a fantastic practice. Because what it does, it grounds you in the present moment, right? And then your thinking mind, which wants to create the future of disaster, if I'm worried, you don't let it go there. You don't let it go there. So you purify the heart of that fear because you've honored it. You haven't gotten rid of it. Like try to repress it, but you've stayed in the present moment. Whereas if you are sucked into the thinking mind, you take that narrative and you spin it out, and people agree with you, you can get really, really, you suffer a lot, right? And just go in a downward spiral. So we do face very real inner upwellings of difficult things, yeah? and in the way you say Ajahn Chah would teach, he'd say, well, that's where you get your strength, in the very fear and the very anger and aversion. That's where you get your strength. It's very hard to be mindful there. It's very easy just to spin out into thought. That's easy to do, right? So it's very hard to be mindful, or to go into self-analysis, or go into self-blame, or distract with some kind of compensation, but to actually just be with something very unpleasant, like this fear for this person, and to do what you're doing. And that's what you learn when you feel discomfort in your hip during the meditation. And that's what I learned sitting on a concrete floor. That even this will change. Even this will change. Right? And so that's the language of Buddhism, that which arises ceases. It's not me. That which begins ends. It's not me. This will change. It's not me. And to introduce that language when there's very strong upwellings is hard to do because it's so believable. Doubt is so, it seems so real. The fear seems so real. The betrayal seems so real. And so the ego, the sense of self gets in there and, you know, makes a real mess of it. And then we remember, oh yeah, life is this way now. It feels this way. And so there's so much emphasis in Buddhism around really doing things well. So like, that our monastic training, the way you bow, the way you fold your sitting cloth, the way you wash your bowl, all these things have importance, not as just some kind of blind Buddhist rituals, but as ways of composure, So say you notice, like, we come into the shrine room and we stop. We compose our minds. We bow. We bow. And so we come back to the moment. And as you appreciate what awareness practice is, it's such a beautiful place to just rest in the moment. To just rest with your hands. To just look at the Buddha and just to bow. It's lovely. Really lovely. And what's not terribly lovely is this kind of projection into the future and self-disparagement and all that. It's the complexity of habit. And then there's the composure, the composure. And this is a craft, isn't it? It is a training. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes quite a strong intention to do this. But it's obviously very, very meaningful because it's about our own minds, and that's where we live. We don't live in Almont or Ottawa. We live in our consciousness, in our minds. And then we make of Almont or Ottawa or Tisserna what we want, what our minds make of it. So to find that place of refreshment and ease in one's heart is a lovely thing, and then it's shared, because what else would one do? All right, I'll leave that for your reflection today. Tandamayam varagataya sadhukaram gramasi.